Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio. Live at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, this is The Tidbit brought to you by Curate. I'm your host, Kim Bryden. So what are your business goals for the new year? Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Well, here at The Tidbit, we've got your back. Each week, we'll talk through tidbits of knowledge around starting a small business in the DC and Baltimore metro areas with featured guests and chat about new tips and trends in the food industry. And if you want to know more beyond the podcast, well, The Tidbit is inspired by a bi-weekly newsletter that we send out at Curate. You can subscribe to learn more about what we're reading, eating, drinking, and learning. Go to curateconnect.com and sign up in the footer. That's curate, C-U-R-E-A-T-E, connect.com. So happy 2018, y'all. I am so thrilled to tell you about what I am eating today. I had the awesome privilege of staying here at the Line last night. And let me tell you, I have two favorite hours here at the hotel. One is golden hour when the sun is setting and this beautiful stained glass window, the sun comes through and it just creates this glow. It is perfect for an afternoon tea. And my other favorite hour, maybe this is because my mother entertains people with cake and coffee. So I'm always on the hunt for a good cake and coffee spot in the city. But let me tell you, the desserts here at Brothers and Sisters Restaurant, out of this world. Grab a nook in the lounge area, grab a pour over or the tea, the Mount Olympus flower tea is amazing, and get the Okinawa dessert. It is beautiful. It is mochi, which is rice flour with rice pudding on the inside with accents of pistachio and persimmon. Taking one bite, I had to know who made this dessert. Like, what is the story of this? And that's when I found out more about Piché Ong, which is the pastry chef here for Brothers and Sisters. And he actually is a James Beard nominated pastry chef who once worked in New York restaurants like Jean Georges, Spice Market. He's a cookbook author. He's a resident judge on Cake Wars. And I was just thrilled to learn that such a talent is here collaborating and working with another visionary chef, Eric Brenner Yang, who's the restaurateur of Brothers and Sisters and the founder of Foreign National Restaurant Group. Actually, did you know that Chef Eric also has a show here on Full Service Radio? So I definitely encourage you to check that out. And another fun fact is that Chef Eric Brenner Yang is also a part of a chef network of a locally founded nonprofit here called World Central Kitchen. And World Central Kitchen, their purpose is to use the power of food to empower communities and strengthen economies. And this is part of the tidbit I want to talk about today, this notion of food as activism. And so, to dive a little bit more into this notion, I want to use World Central Kitchen as an example. So Chef Jose Andres is the founder and chairman of World Central Kitchen. And Chef Jose has been a staple of the DC food community since being a part of the opening of Haleo in 1993. Haleo is a Spanish tapas restaurant in Chinatown, which is a little bit north of the National Mall. It can be located off of the Red and Green Line. And besides Haleo being one of the first establishments in that area in 93, since then, Jose has opened Oyamel, which is a Mexican Oaxacan restaurant just across the street from Haleo. China Chilcano, which is on the same block as Haleo, which is a Peruvian Japanese restaurant, Zaytinya, which is also in that Penn Quarter area, which is Mediterranean, and Mini Bar, which is his 25-course molecular gastronomy restaurant. So needless to say, Jose has been a huge staple of the DC food community, but he's also opened restaurants in Miami, Vegas, Los Angeles, and Puerto Rico. And so as of late, you may have heard of Chef Jose's name because of his work in Puerto Rico and World Central Kitchen's work in Puerto Rico, feeding over 3 million meals post-Hurricane Maria. I actually had the humbling experience of going to Puerto Rico with World Central Kitchen for Thanksgiving. And let me tell you, it was empowering to see the framework that World Central Kitchen created, activating the local community. I think it's really important that we think about economic development empowerment as doing something with community as opposed to for community. And what do I mean by that? I mean, going there, boots on the ground, we saw firsthand that the local food trucks were activated. They were preparing the meals. They were distributing the hot meals into the communities that needed it the most. And not only, you know, it wasn't just a granola bar. It was a hot meal. And that hot meal created inspiration and hope and just makes you feel like someone cares for you and looks out for you, you know, that warm feeling in your belly. And that was so inspiring to see. And so, like I said at the top of, you know, this tidbit, being able to see this food as activism, you know, taking a stand for something. What do you believe in? And how are you able to translate that power of food into this greater hope and inspiration? And again, it's doing something with the community, not for them. You know, we are bringing people together around this shared meal and this shared hope. And I really believe that this is going to be one of the biggest trends of 2018. We can't separate business and purpose anymore. They have to be intertwined. Taking that stand, creating action, putting your dollars into what you believe, you know, this is the movement that's been sparked. You can't just sit on the sidelines anymore. Your business and what you do in life, it has to have that taking a stand, that purpose. And it's not going away. So how are you going to create values-oriented action within your business this year? We're going to post show notes over on our blog, and we want you to leave a comment. Tell us, how are you going to create this values-oriented action? So go over to curate.co/blog, that's curate.co/blog, and check out the notes post-show. We're going to dive deeper into this sentiment along with other notable food trends we see emerging in 2018 with Marissa Dobson. Marissa is the founder and principal of Scintillate, a consulting agency that specializes in food and lifestyle clients. And for over 10 years, she's worked with professional creatives to turn their passions into passion projects. So stay tuned and learn more about how living and working in Baltimore has shaped her food activism views and what she sees as emerging trends after the break.
And this little break song right here, it's called Persian Gold from Kenny Brown, local DC native. We'll be right back on the tidbit. This is Full Service Radio. We'll be right back.
We're back with Marissa Dobson, founder and principal of Scintillate, a consulting agency based in Baltimore that specializes in food and lifestyle clients. Hey, Marissa.
Hey, Kim.
I'm so glad you're here.
This is super exciting.
Happy 2018.
Happy New Year to you. This is a beautiful space. I love the energy here. The hotel is very cool.
I know, the vibrancy.
Mm-hmm.
It's emanating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was saying at the top of the show that there's a lot of stories that are intertwined into the restaurant concepts that are here. And I tend to believe that those who enter into the food industry see food and beverage as a means of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally think you're a shining example
as
to how your background has been punctuated with different food and beverage moments that has shaped you from a young age. And obviously has empowered you to become the storyteller you are today. So you were born in Baltimore.
I was. You know, it's funny. Now that I live in Baltimore, I hesitate to say that I'm from there because I was just born there.
Okay.
But I feel like there were actually several points in time where one or another things brought me back to that city. So I was born in Mercy Hospital, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad, who was a chef and chef instructor, he actually got his degree at Baltimore International College, I think is what it was called. It's called BIC for short. And that's where he got his culinary degree. So Baltimore has always been a big part of sort of my identity and definitely like the major entry point for my like food and beverage experience. So yeah, that was my dad. My dad was a chef and a chef, private chef for a little while. He worked back of house in a bunch of different restaurants and hotels. And then my mom also worked front of house. So I actually, in effect, grew up in a restaurant. One of my earliest memories actually is of helping my dad peel and prep shrimp at one of those like take your daughter to work days. And my dad always tells this funny story about how he'd like set me up with a couple, you know, shrimp, and I was like peeling the shrimp. He was at a seafood restaurant outside of Ocean City at the time. And there was some other prep cook who was like also on the line, like working alongside me. And he was just apparently like going out of his mind with like how slow and like, you know, silly I was, like taking off every single one of the legs at a time. You know, so I've been part of this industry in one way or another for a really long time. But the interesting thing is that I was always like a really big bookworm.
Mm.
So I came through it through my adult career through book publishing. So I went to school, was an English major, thought I wanted to get into publishing, got into the nonfiction world,
mm-hmm.
Which always appealed to me a little bit more. I mean, I read a lot of fiction, obviously, for fun, but nonfiction is much more meaningful to pitch, I believe.
Mm.
I'm probably going to get some emails about that, but but that was how I got into cookbooks. And now my like current situation is I'm working with not only cookbook authors, but I'm also working with chefs and restaurants, different kinds of establishments. I work with people who have products, all different kinds of food and beverage businesses. And this is really, it's come kind of full circle, and it's all of my favorite things. It's books, it's food, it's cocktails, it's cool people who are doing really awesome things. And
yeah. And I feel like the way you've been able to establish yourself and your business is you're choosing chefs, makers who have values alignment with yourself.
Totally, totally.
And I think that's one of the most rewarding parts of it is how you see the values and heartstrings of what you believe in the world and helping tell that story of that chef or maker through their product or cookbook.
Yeah, no, I think we're both like this, actually. I feel like when you work for yourself, I mean, why work for yourself and take on all of that responsibility and all of that additional stress of hustling for yourself if it's not in order to work with people that you're really passionate about? So that's something that was very important to me from the very beginning. The first client I ever had was Matt and Nato from Baked in Brooklyn, and I helped them open up their first store in Manhattan in Tribeca. And the reason why I wanted to work with them was that they were just fabulous interesting, motivated people. And I felt like they had a really interesting story. And that, you know, that was sort of like the first of many instances like that. So, yeah, no, I think not only am I attracted to people who have that sort of drive, but I also think that those are the stories that are most worth telling.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we move into 2018 and talk about, you know, what are these food trends that are popping up? We see all of these headlines around, you know, in yesteryear it was maybe an avocado toast, but I actually want to talk about trends as it relates to movements. And, you know, at the top of the show, we talked about food as activism. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's a movement that's been born, and I referenced Chef Jose Andres and his work in Puerto Rico and using the power of food to create change. And you know, seeing that as food activism has been a long staple of our culture, but it seems even more top of mind right now. I'm thinking back to at the end of the year with the powerful spotlight of the hashtag MeToo movement. We've seen this ripple effect of women standing up and taking ownership. So I'm wondering, you know, with this context of, again, new trends for 2018, but of a larger context of movements that are created in the food industry, what are your thoughts about food activism in 2018? And in regards to what I just said, specifically with women, more women taking the lead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think food activism has definitely been a hot topic for probably the last decade or so. But I think that there has been sort of a crystallization of a lot of these thoughts recently. And I mean, I have been lucky to be involved with Food Book Fair for the last couple of years. And I think that Kim and Amanda there are doing some really incredible organizing and are now taking the show on the road. So I'm really excited to see what they're going to do there and the sort of conversations that they're going to be hosting there. But I think also just in the last year, I've seen, you know, there was that book Feed the Resistance that came out.
Right.
And that was like something like a 6-month turnaround that, you know, people submitted and they got that out there and all the proceeds went to the ACLU. So that, I think, is a really good example of something that is very, very current and something that people felt super passionate about and just like made it happen. And I mean, if you know anything about the book industry, you know that a 6-month turnaround like that is near impossible. So everyone along that chain had to be totally invested in that to make that happen. And then there are other things that I've noticed too, like that America, the Great Cookbook that Joe Yonan put out. I think that there has been a re-examination of sort of the contributions of immigrants
absolutely
in the kitchen. And then I think in regards to women in the food and beverage industry, I mean, I was actually just talking to my parents about this over the holidays, their experience and, you know, whether they found any of these headlines about any of these famous chefs or restaurateurs surprising. They didn't, shocker. But I think something that I thought, something my dad said that I thought was really insightful was that he actually only observed this sort of behavior in what we think of as sort of fine dining or higher end. So he worked the whole gamut, like I said, even as a private chef, which, you know, working in someone's home is a very intimate thing too. But the only time that he ever sort of witnessed things like this was when he was in so-called fine dining establishments. And he said it very simply and straightforwardly that, you know, it's because they have more power. So I think there has been sort of a shift away from this sort of fine dining culture. And I think that this movement will maybe hasten that process. Not only do I think people find the sort of tasting menu, 3-hour dining bothersome, but now I think maybe a lot of them will be wondering what's going on, you know,
the power
in the kitchen.
Dynamics. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, that shift away from fine dining coupled with our collective consciousness now of wanting to experience more collaborative or collective, you know, businesses in general and bringing more of that feminine energy, even, you know, woman owned or not, but having that feminine energy of collaboration.
Exactly.
Yeah. And being transparent as to who are the individuals who are in power, so to speak, like who are the people you are empowering and those who are building those foundations for success. I think we as consumers are taking more note of that.
Oh, totally. And I've seen that. I know we're going to talk about Baltimore in the next segment, but I've seen that Baltimore has always been this bastion of collaboration, but I've seen that especially so in the community of women around me recently. I mean, not only are they all these social organizations that have been popping up, like Society for Excellent Women, but there's the Mira Kitchen Collective. There's my friend Carlene is doing pop-ups with their Liberian food. I mean, there's so many different sort of women-centered and women-focused food and entertainment and third place options that have been opening up recently. And I think we've seen it in sort of the political climate as well, like more women running for office. And I think that is just something that is moving out into all of the, you know, sectors of life, hopefully. But I think I something that I still feel like we don't have a lot of is women owners.
Uh-huh.
I've seen more women as executive chefs, and I've seen women doing these collaborative projects, which is amazing. But I think something that we're all sort of grappling with right at this moment is, how do we deal with financing? You know, power structures having to do with how these people get money to launch or fund their projects. And I know you work on that, you know, day in and day
out. Absolutely. But, and not just the tangible money, but then the emotions that surround money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just our, you know, decades, centuries of the emotional worthiness
mm-hmm. that the has powers to do that with, be feel with so much more comfortable writing a big check to a man. I mean, that uh-huh. is just the way it is. And I think that we will probably not see the kind of change we want unless the money changes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it's these implicit biases that you don't know are there mm-hmm. until you start calling them out and sort of shifting the structures.
Mm-hmm.
But going again on these food trends of 2018, another one that has been maybe not as long as a decade now, but that's been on the rise is the no waste movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working on a new book that touches on this topic. So I'm wondering if you could
I'll tell you a little bit about it. I don't want to give away too much because the book is still far out, but I'm working with Julia Tertian on her new book that's about using up leftovers in a novel way. And when I say working with, I'm publicizing it. She writes it entirely on her own. But I think that it's really interesting because I think that it is the perfect example of the natural progression of things. You know, we've been talking about no waste in restaurants for a really long time and repurposing food for the needy. And, you know, we've had Misfit Juicery here in DC, and there are lots of these like no waste companies. But I think that a lot of people don't really know how to deal with that in their own home kitchen. You know, there are a lot of people who just throw away the tops of green onions, or, you know, don't use their carrot tops, or, you know, all of these things that are perfectly edible and delicious, you know, items. And I think that as the general population becomes more aware of that, we'll probably continue to move away from meal kits and want to be less wasteful, both in packaging and in using ingredients to their fullest extent.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Something that I've just done like the last couple of months or month, I should say, is I've actually started using lard, which I've never ever done before. But it kind of naturally occurred during another recipe, and I felt so guilty throwing it away that I decided to keep it. And then we wound up using it as our as an added ingredient in our masa for our tamales on Christmas Eve. And it was so good. It was really good.
Yeah. I mean, cooking at home brings you that sense of nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and, you know, feeding the soul. And I feel like when we're not at home, we're seeking third spaces that, you know, a third space isn't home or work, but one that is providing that sense of rejuvenation and nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our brick and mortar establishments are realizing that we as consumers are craving that same sort of nourishment feeling that home provides us, and, you know, this respite from daily life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think we're seeking this dining experience that provides more connection and intimacy, Yeah, and I'm wondering, is that something you see as a trend as well coming up in 2018?
Yeah, totally. I feel like you see this nationwide. I mean, I wrote down a couple. I mean, there's Single Thread. There's the Lost Kitchen up in Maine. Mama Lee's, which just got the write-up in New York Times in Queens. And then I really think Ida B's Table in Baltimore is a really good example of that, too. I mean, all of these are places where they're either run by a husband and wife team or they're run by sort of a family matriarch. And your experience there feels very much like you're part of the family, you're part of the community. What you're getting there is not just nourishing your body, but it's also nourishing your soul.
I love that.
And I feel like that is something, you know, millennials get this sort of like bad rap as being like so into their phones. But I definitely feel like this trend is related to sort of a reaction against digital life. Like when people go out now, they want to like be in spaces with other people.
I'm actually so glad you brought up Ida B's because we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to focus on trends specifically to this region, but more specifically, Baltimore. So after the break, we'll be back.
Sounds good.
And this break song again from Kenny Brown. It's called Turquoise. We'll be right back.
We're back with Marissa Dobson, founder and principal of Scintillate, a consulting agency based in Baltimore that specializes in food and lifestyle clients. Marissa.
Hey, Kim.
We are back to talk about Baltimore.
Me more, baby.
Woo! I've worked in Baltimore for the past 3 years, and it has been overwhelmingly this feeling, this sense of community and camaraderie. It's palpable in the city. I really think it's a part of the city's DNA, like the framework of the city. You know, even when times get tough, it's us that has each other's backs. And maybe it's a statement of second and third tier cities in America in general, but it's unmistakable in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And since the uprising and Freddie Gray's death in 2015, I'm wondering if you could talk more about how you've seen the community, specifically the food community in Baltimore, rise together.
Yeah, so obviously that's a super complicated question and one that I'm not entirely qualified to answer, but I can at least share my observations.
Of course.
And that is that a big reason why I moved to Baltimore was because of that community. The people there not only care about each other, but it's a small city in that everyone either lives or works or runs into each other at the at Club Charles. I mean, like, it really is, you know, a small, small place. It's called Smalltimore. Yeah. and I think the people there do genuinely care for each other and try to, you know, make it a better city for the most part for each other because they realize that there's not too much help that's going to be coming from the outside. So it's kind of up to us. Yeah. So specifically in regards to how I feel the food and beverage community has reacted to the uprising, I mean, I think there were a lot of people who were like totally convinced that after that, you know, all the businesses were going to close, everyone with any money was going to pack up and leave. And I think that was a little overblown. I am happy to say that, I mean, I know of a ton of Black-owned businesses that, have continued to thrive and, have even come up, you know, in the time since then. I think that this is partly to do with, you know, the community really coming out in support of them. But I also think that it is also due to a number of programs that have started recently that are incubator-like programs. I school food has been helpful. And
ooh.
Yeah.
I feel like I haven't even mentioned school food on this show yet.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a year-long educational curriculum for food and beverage business owners that I run in collaboration with Humanum, which is a workforce development nonprofit in East Baltimore. We've seen about 120 business owners through the program now. Mm-hmm. So that's been really, like you said, really awesome to see this community and camaraderie around business ownership and being able to source from one another,
mm-hmm.
and then also see how we can transition consumers' purchasing dollars into these smaller businesses.
Yeah, so just to work off of that for a second, I think Ida B's Table is another good example of this, because I think, did Couples Tea work with you guys?
Couples Tea, Mel from City Weeds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Ida B's Table is a restaurant in downtown Baltimore, and it's a beautiful, huge space that serves modern soul food. Chef David Thomas and Tanya Thomas are the ones who run it, and they now have the ability with their restaurant to not only buy from local minority-owned farms, urban farms, but now they also buy and stock products from local Baltimore-based businesses. So they, you know, they buy all of their tea from Couples Tea. They have, you know, get things from Zaradka Farms, from Real Food Farms, Liberty Delight Farms. And I think that this sort of, business support is incredibly important, mm-hmm. especially among, businesses that may not have traditional financial support, like we were discussing. So
it's creating stable purchase orders for them.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So, and I think, there are a couple others that have been coming up that are not sort of that model. I mean, I was really happy to see this past year, Black Sauce Kitchen is this really popular farmers market stand at both the big farmers market underneath 83, and they also have an outpost at Waverly. And Black Sauce Kitchen got their first standalone establishment now, so you can go there on Thursdays and get Black Sauce Kitchen and from to go. You don't have to wait till the weekend anymore.
And their establishment's in the neighborhood of Remington,
yeah, correct,
which is near Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, I mean, everything is near Johns Hopkins, really, in the center of the city. I'd say Remington is most famous now probably for their food hall. Our house is, another one of these establishments or institutions that I think have come up in the last couple of years that could be a good launch pad for businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So School Food has been helpful. Humanum's work has obviously been helpful. Our house has been part of that scene. Be More Kitchen is another one like that, that are these sort of incubators or accelerator spaces that are now available. There's Mount Vernon Marketplace, too. That's where Yule is with Big Bean Theory.
Mm-hmm.
I know Jasmine Norton has had a couple urban oyster pop-ups at our house. So that's one of the only actually Black female chefs that I know of who's like doing her own thing. Has her own business.
Wow.
And she's been able to do a couple successful events from what I've heard at our house. Yeah.
We are going to link to all of these places in our show notes. So you can definitely tune into our blog to check them out. And, going off of that, I feel like Baltimore has always had this really strong creative energy as well. And something I've realized about the food community in Baltimore as it relates to this creative energy, the musical history of this city, its vibrant, diverse population,
Art school helps. I mean, Micah, yeah definitely. That helps too with that sort of creative energy.
Pennsylvania Avenue was the heyday of jazz back in the day. So food, culture, music, it's always been this strong, backbone of the city. And I don't know that many people outside of Baltimore realize how culturally diverse the city is.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because there's an incredible amount of culinary creatives popping up from many different, cultural melting pots and different viewpoints. So, you know, what opportunities do you see popping up over this next year?
Well, I think that there definitely is a lot of interest in, so I think a lot of people both in and outside of Baltimore think that Baltimoreans are kind of like only into pub food and crab cakes. And it really like breaks my heart a little bit, because anytime anyone opens anything else, like a taco stand, I mean, Clavel has done incredibly well. Oh, another woman owned and fronted a restaurant in Baltimore. Let's Lane. Yeah. At Clavel. Not anytime anyone opens Ekiben. I mean, there's Tortilla Sinaloa, which is amazingly popular. Anytime someone opens something else, ramen is super hot right now. There's like a second outpost of Me and You, the noodle that just opened up in Hamden. Please, 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 if anyone's listening, give us more ethnic, quote unquote, food options, because I think the city is like starving for it. And I think that they're super supportive of it.
It's not just crab cakes and burger cookies.
I think that there's also something really really interesting happening right now with the Filipino population. I mean, I'm good friends with Dylan Ubaldo, who is also known as Toyo Mansi, and he is a perfect example of what you're talking about. He comes from a music and organizing background, and this past year he did this amazing pop-up called Kalasag. I know I talked to you about it a couple times. Ooh. Like, it was incredible. They put together this enormous feast out on this outdoors at this place called The Compound, which you would never discover. It's in the middle of some warehouses in this non-residential part of Baltimore. And you went back there, and there was karaoke, and there was this beautiful bar with cocktails that were designed by Genghis, and so that was so successful that that core group of Asian Americans, not just Filipinos, I mean, there are a couple Taiwanese I know who helped out, Taiwanese Americans, they are going to start doing more collaborations going forward, because, I mean, they sold out of that, I think, in a couple of days. And I know that Dylan is planning on doing another pop-up with Kalasag at Ida B's Table actually later this month. I don't have the date on that, but if we're going to link up after this, I'll send you guys the link. I think it's like the third weekend of January or something like that. Amazing. So they're actually going to do something really cool. There are a lot of obviously similarities between soul food and Filipino food, because both rely so much on resourcefulness, using what I guess we would call offcuts, using a lot of actually the same grains. The vegetables that they do use, which are not tons of vegetables, but the vegetables they do use are very similar. You know, they're sort of like the hardier
collards
or hardier sort of like dandelion green type things, right? You know, that grow up out of the ground. Yeah,
and that resourcefulness, this collective community, the creativity, I think those three traits coupled together is what's creating this perfect storm in Baltimore. You know, with the more affordable nature of the city in contrast to DC, I think it breeds almost this market research opportunity in a way, because you can take risks, you can be bold, you can have this more vibrant creative expression I've seen in the city, because maybe it's a lower barrier to entry. Maybe it's because the community sort of provides that social safety net, because they're going to show up for you.
Yeah.
but whatever it is, it's really birthed this vibrancy that I've seen, you know, just growing and expanding. And it's definitely not going to stop this year.
I hope not. I mean, I'm very excited about what's coming up next. And I have witnessed a lot of growth in just the last year and a half. There are lots of really exciting things coming up. But I do want to touch on a little bit of something that you kind of talked about there, which I think is like price sensitivity in the city versus DC. I definitely think that there is sort of a different, there's like a different moral element to price sensitivity in Baltimore, because we live so close to each other, and the economic like destitution of certain neighborhoods is so apparent. It's not like it's beyond rude when you price things like too high for the city. It's not that people won't pay it, because there is money in the city and people will pay it. But it's you definitely have to be, I think, more conscious of the fact that, you know, we have a couple local block residents who like live around Ida B's table, and we, you know, regularly feed them. And at the same time, we have people who come into the restaurant and say that it's a little too expensive for soul food. So, I mean, I think that there's this interesting boundary that you have to, you know, that you have to walk as a restaurant door bar or establishment in Baltimore. Like, you have to make sure that you are giving back in a sustainable way and that you're not pricing out, you know, the majority of the city.
Yeah, it's running a business, having more of a sociocultural context as to where you're operating and running. And, you know, as we wrap here, I asked our listeners at the top of the show, you know, how are they going to create this values-oriented action in their businesses this year? So do you have any final words and thoughts about your 2018 and what you hope for?
Yeah, so my 2018, I mean, I bought a house last year, so that was a big deal, and I bought it in Baltimore City, so that was definitely a very conscious decision on my part to, you know, pay my water bill, pay my city taxes, all of that jazz. So 2018, I'm my big goal is to get my house in order and improve my block. You know, there are a lot of big systemic problems in the city and in every city. But one of the things that I'm really passionate about is at least improving my little bit that I can. I live in this really adorable hamlet of Baltimore City called Lowerville, and there are a number of business properties that are available there. So I'm going to do my best to try and fill those too, get the word out to people about the affordability and wonderful community that's there. So I've been taking a lot of meetings in and around my neighborhood to get people to come up to that part of the city.
I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all we can do is, you know, help create change in the communities that we are a part of.
Yep.
So speaking of that, this podcast is made possible by supporters like you. Consider making a monthly donation on our Patreon page, patreon.com/thetidbit. If you become our coffee friend, we are actually, throughout the show, we're going to feature three entrepreneurs and their projects to be granted the funds that we raise through the podcast. So if you donate, you'll get to vote on the project that receives the funds.
Awesome.
So that's right. You have the power to put your dollars right back into the local economy, be that, you know, agent of change like Marissa is going to be in her neighborhood. So join us. Head over to Patreon, patreon.com/thetidbit. Thank you, Marissa, for being here.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Until next time, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
The theme song for the tidbit, it's called Nas. It's by Franklin, another DC local. Actually goes by Franklin Robertson. Again, this has been the tidbit on Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.